This week is Parashat Korach, and the story of Korach is a complex story. It's a story of rebellion, and it raises immediately a chronological problem, which actually speaks to a much larger problem about the literary makeup of Chumash. Because if you think about the story of Korach, which comes on the heels in the literary flow of things, on the heels of the what we call Chetam Meraglim and the consequences of that, there's something very strange about it, which is that Korach at this point mounts a rebellion against the selection of Aharon as the Kohen, and the timing is a little weird, because actually the Levites were the ones who were totally left out of the story of the Meraglim. They didn't have somebody who sent, they weren't singled out for punishment, they weren't singled out for citation or anything. They're just not part of the story. The question is, why are they here? But there's a larger problem in the story, is, and we're going to look at it in detail, but is the test that Moshe gives to Korach, when Korach presents his challenge, the test that Moshe gives to Korach is, okay, let's get 200, you know, get all your men together, and everybody bring a censer and put a ketoret in it, and whoever God chooses, that will be the Holy One, who will be the selected member of Bnei Levi. Now, if you are Korach, or you are one of his henchmen, it turns out to be 250 guys, and you hear this as the test. By the way, you have an option, right, which is the old Goliath problem. I'll take you back a little bit. And there's something kind of strange that happens here that also happens there in the story of Goliath. The Shaul and his army line up against the Plishtim. Well, we know the story. And they're all lined up, ready to go to war. And suddenly this huge guy, this colossus, comes out of the Plishti camp with all this armor on him and yells and says, listen, why should we go to war? I am Plishti, and you guys are all servants of or slaves to Shaul. Let's go mano a mano, and whoever wins, wins. So if I beat you, which I'm going to do, then you'll all become our slaves, and you beat me, ha-ha, never happened, then we'll be your slaves. Now, the interesting thing about this is it's a false dichotomy, meaning that he's offering us an alternative, which is not really a false dichotomy. It's a suppressed choice, meaning either you're going to win or I'm going to win, and then there's a third alternative, which is we don't want your whole deal. We're just going to go to war army against army. But nobody goes that way. They're so cowed by Goliath that they buy into his choice, and they say, well, we can't fight you, so we're going to sit here with a tail between the legs until some kid comes up with a slingshot and wins the war. And the same thing sort of happens here. Moshe says, okay, you guys get your censers together, etc. Now, the people could say, okay, we give up. You won. You bluffed us out. Or they could say, okay, we'll do it, which is what they do. Dumb decision. There's also a third choice, which is they could say, no, we don't like your, we don't agree with your choice of Aharon. We don't agree with your choice of tests. And we think that you chose with nepotism. We think you chose wrongly, whatever it is. And we're just going to declare ourselves to be Kohanim. Or we're going to derive a different test. Each one of us is going to stand up and hold a stick in the air. And whichever stick waves, I don't know, I'm making something up. But instead, they buy into it. Now, what's really odd about this is that if we're at this point in history, that means that we are somewhere in the middle of the second year, meaning that we left Egypt a year ago. And we've been at the foot of Har Sinai for almost a year. So it's now the end of the spring of the second year. And then we started marching. And then we'll go with Chazal that it was Tisha B'Av when the decree of the Meraglim. So it's a couple months later, which means it has been less than 5 months since the dedication of the Mishkan. Now, what happened on the first day of the dedication of the Mishkan? Which in most, according to most, is Rosh Chodesh Nisan. It's the eighth day of Nisan. What happened?
The Aharon's sons are killed.
The Aharon's sons are killed. How were they killed?
By God.
Right. And the fire came down and devoured them, and they were holding censers with Torah in it. So I got to ask you, as we say in Brooklyn, what kind of idiot's going to agree to a test to stand up in front of God with a censer and Torah and say, hit me with your best shot? Because, by the way, either way, you could be a loser. Meaning, if God chose Aaron, which is the case, and the other guys who show up are fakes, then they're going to get burned up. And by the way, if one of those guys believes I'm the real dude, he might also get burned up, because what did Moshe say to Aaron after Nadav and Abihu were killed? Oh, this is what God said. He becomes sanctified through those who are close to him. It could be that Moshe is saying, okay, let's see who God chooses to burn. Why would anybody do this? And this leads us to the problem of when this whole story happened. Now, we have to note that the Ben Ezra, right here at the beginning on source 4, already takes the position. Now, remember, the Ibn Ezra, along with most Rishonim, is of the approach that the story of the Torah is not told in order, and that the literary structure of the Torah, the literary sequencing of the Torah, is driven by other considerations, not chronology. And of course, the Machloket becomes very famous in the context of the relationship between the commands to build the Mishkan and the Chet HaEgel. The Ibn Ezra and Rashi and others all say that the command to build the Mishkan was the result of the Egel, even though in the Torah, the Egel is told afterwards. The Ramban famously says everything's in order. Yesh Muktam Muchabra Torah, we talked about it a few years ago. But here you have it as an example here.
Presumably, Korach must believe that what he's claiming is in some way fundamentally different than all the other problems preceding him.
If they preceded him, correct. In other words, if you're coming on the heels of all those other things that happen, including Nadav and Avihu, and you think, well, I'm getting, you know, what do they say? That one of the greatest signs of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and thinking you get a different result. So a slight form of that is the old phrase, I'm different.
Right.
Right. Because I can hit the pedal in the middle and it'll go because I have different feet. Right. No, that's still a brake pedal. So if Korach thinks my claim is a more justified claim than what? Than Nadav and Avihu, they weren't making a claim. So let's take a look at it. The Ibn Ezra here says, Vayikach Korach, source 4, Zeh hadavar hayah b'midbar Sinai, meaning before they left Har Sinai, which in the chronology now they've gone, Kasher nitchalfu habechorim v'nivdalu halvi'im. It was at that point when the firstborn were swapped for the Levim. That Bnei Israel thought Moshe was doing this to promote his own tribe as nepotism. And Gamli Bnei Kahat Shem Kovim Elav, and he specifically picked out his subfamily, Kahat, Ulcho Bnei Levi Shem Mishpachto. While Levim Kashu Elav, so the other Levim ganged up on him, which is it's an odd thing. But we're talking to Tunim La'aron Levanav. In other words, the way the Ibn Ezra is structuring it, I think he's honest in the here, but I disagree with his conclusion, is that at the point where Moshe swapped the Levim, told them that you have to take all the Bechorot who have been sanctified with Makat Bechorot, that became sanctified that night in Egypt, and swap them for the Levim, so the Levim now become sanctified, and then the 273 surplus Bechorot you have to redeem with the five Shkolim. So he said, oh, at that point, all the rest of Am Yisrael said, oh, Moshe is promoting his own tribe. And then the Levim got angry because they said, and you're turning all of us as subservient to your brother Aaron. And so that opened things up. Right? And so therefore, v'kashar datan v'aviram b'avur she'sira v'choram v'ruveno b'yem v'natan al Yosef. And then he says, oh, that's why Datan and Aviram, who are members of the tribe of Reuven, get roped into this. I'm going to read it differently. Get roped into this because they have the same kind of claim. Reuven was the elder brother, and therefore we should be the elder tribe. And now you're taking that away and giving it to Levi. This is a very difficult claim, I think. But the point I'm trying to bring out is that the Ibn Ezra was also bothered by the chronology. When did this happen? Now, the Ramban, true to form, here in source 5, just simply says that this happened after the Meraglim. And you see in the bold section, V'kasher chatuba Meraglim. Lepo Moshe aleyem v'lo batlag zeram meyem. When the 10 guys got killed, Moshe did not pray for them. Moshe did pray that God shouldn't destroy everybody else. Who died? The leaders of 10 of the tribes, not Levi, by the way, were killed. And the decree was that everybody else will die in the desert. Then people start getting upset at Moshe. Things aren't working well. So Korach now found the wedge. It's a good argument to saying that Korach is pulling his rebellion now because it's like an advantageous moment. Everybody's already upset at Moshe about the Meraglim. It's a great time. Strike while the iron is hot. It works except for this problem, is that if this is happening now in the summer of the second year, why would anybody agree to a test with the Ketoret? It's suicide. And it, by the way, turns out to be suicide, as we'll see. So I want to go in a slightly different direction to start and then come back to the text and talk about the chronology of what happened and suggest something different. But again, it has to do with the literary nature of narratives in the Torah. There is a famous midrash in the Tanhuma that Korach utilized tzitzit as a way of publicly challenging Moshe. And the famous story goes that Korach got his 250 men out there and they all put on a garment that was purely tchelet. And he said, Moshe, does this garment need tzitzit? And Moshe said, yes. And he said, well, that's silly. If one tchelet string can work for the whole garment, then why would a garment that needs it all need it? Right. Where'd they get that from? They got that from Smichuta Parshiot, because the source number one, which is the Parsha of Tzitzis, is right before Korach, meaning the story of Korach comes immediately afterwards. So you got to say, look, why is these two things connected? It must be that the story of Tzitzit has something to do with Korach. Well, indeed, it does have something to do with Korach, but in a much more obvious way than using as part of Korach's argument. Let's think about what's happened. B'nai Yisrael are in the Midbar, and sitting in the middle of the camp is the Mishkan, and the chief operators of the Mishkan, the officials of the Mishkan, are the Kohanim, and among them, Father Aaron is the Kohen Gadol, and the Kohen Gadol is distinguished from the other Kohanim with four garments, and the uppermost of those garments is a strap that goes across his head of gold that says, Kodesh Hashem. That's called the tzitz. Okay, very good. We know about the tzitz. And source two says, you make a tzitz. And by the way, how is the tzitz held on? It's held on with petil techelet, with a blue string that goes in back. In other words, it's tied in back, and that's how it's held onto his head. Very nice. And we've got this Mishkan, and everybody knows that Bezalel worked very hard to make all these things, including a beautiful tzitz, tied with a petil techelet that Aaron, our Kohen Gadol, wears when he goes in. Beautiful, all right, when he does Avodah. Then here we are in the Midbar, and after the whole episode with the Meraglim, we suddenly hear about a new mitzvah. I'm going to backtrack on this later. A new mitzvah called tzitzit. And what are we told about? Let's take a look at the parsha of tzitzit against the backdrop of being in the desert, in the camp with the Mishkan. Now, when you hear the word tzitzit, it sounds like a little tzitz. And where are we going to put it? Al kanfei vigdehem ledorotam, v'natnu al tzitzit hakanaf til techelet. So put these tzitzit on their garments, on the corners, and put on them a p'til techelet. This sounds exactly like the Kohen Gadol. And who's going to do it? Everybody. And then when you put this together, it will now be called tzitzit, the tzitzit and tchelet. Or itemotos chartemet kol mitzvot adonai vasitemotam. You'll see it and you'll do all the mitzvot. Wow. And then watch this. We're going to talk about that phrase. Do not stray after your eyes. Leman tizkeru vasitemet kol mitzvotai. And here we go. Vitem kedoshim le'loichem. Now you will be holy to God. Now, if I'm in among Am Yisrael, and I'm here in the desert, and this has happened, and I'm told, okay, everybody, you're going to get a little mini tzitz that you put on your garments. Til techelet. And that's a tzitz. Which means now, I'm a little Kohen Gadol, you're a little Kohen, everyone's a little Kohen Gadol, and we're all kedoshim l'loichem. Which means, you make the argument that the caste system has been broken. Or at least that the caste system is not so inviolate. And everybody can be a Kohen Gadol. We already saw that with Nazir. You can be Kohen Gadol for a month or for however long. And this
wasn't that already stipulated in some place in Vayikra?
What was stipulated?
That we be people of...
Sure, absolutely. We're a holy nation. At Har Sinai, Mamlechet Kohanim. All very nice and all very ephemeral. right? The Parshav Kadoshim, Kadoshim to you, ki kadosh ani, beautiful. How are you kadosh? You live a holy life. But now, suddenly, you've got a garment that by wearing it, you're kodesh. Which, by the way, sounds like the Kohen Gadol, who is the holiest guy in the nation, and he wears its seats. So suddenly we're all that. And watch how it comes out with Korach. Vayikalua Moshe v'yal Aharon, Pasuk Gimel. Vayimura lehem rav lachem. Big shots. Ki chol ha'ida kulam kedoshim. What does Korach say? Everybody's kadosh. Uvetocham Adonai. God is in our midst. Umadu atit nasu al kal Adonai. Why are you lording yourself? In other words, they're saying, we have a mitzvah called tzitzit. That's not the way I'm reading it, because it's the immediate previous passage. And the Parsha of Tzitzit says, essentially, that every one of us wears a little bit of a Kohen Gadol's outfit, and we're all Kedoshim. So why are you making a hierarchy of Kedusha? Now, there's a very interesting response that Moshe has, which shows brilliance and real depth of understanding. If you look at Korach's opening salvo, it sounds like Korach is arguing for a breakdown of the class division. No more Kohen Gadol, no more Kohanim, no more Levi'im, everybody's holy. Right? Good. Very nice. I'm not going to call it Marxist, but whatever. But what does Moshe do? Moshe sees through it. And what does he say? Okay, good. Here's what I want you to do. Tomorrow, God's going to let you know which one is Kadosh. Now, at that point, if Korach was honest, what would he say? What do you mean, which one is Kadosh? I'm arguing that we're all Kadosh. But of course, Korach is lying. Korach is not trying to say everybody should be Kadosh. He's trying to say, I should be the one. And Moshe sees through it. And so Moshe doesn't say to him, you know, you're right. Everybody's holy, but some are holier than others. He just cuts right through it and says, you know what, Korach? Let's find out. God's going to decide which one is the Kadosh. And so and Korach buys into it and says, okay, good. We'll do that test. And of course, the Torah thing. So the connection with Tzitzit is pretty clear. It's pretty obvious in Korach's words. But that raises a different question, which is, a broader question, which is, when were we given the mitzvah of tzitzit? When were we given the mitzvah of paraduma? When were we given the mitzvot of matnot kehuna? I'm mentioning things that show up for the first time in Bamidbar. Right? So keep that in mind, and I just want to point out, now we're actually going to stick with this particular point. I want to point out that in this story, there is another rebellion going on, which is Datan and Aviram, who are rebelling not against Aharon, rebelling against Moshe. Every time Datan and Aviram speak, they speak to Moshe. And the claim against Moshe is a claim of bad leadership. You didn't take us out to a good land. You took us out to the desert to die here. And this seems to be something that really happened now after the decree that we're all going to die in the desert. It makes sense. But the Korach thing, which is aimed at Aharon, Moshe and Aharon, it's about the Kuna, seems to have taken place at an earlier point, like the Ibn Ezra says, right? So what we have to do is to separate these out. And that's why, as you see, I color-coded Korach, Datan Aviram, and no, there's no political intent in the colors there. But I want to ask a larger question. The mitzvah of paraduma, which involves also tumat ohel, meaning that you become tameh if you're under the same cover as a dead body, and the purification process from that. When were we told about that? So if you follow the Torah chronologically and you maintain, and the Ramban is not claiming this, and you maintain that the mitzvot that are in Bamidbar Yotet weren't given until that point in history, you got a real problem. Because when's the first time that we encounter death as a problem of tumah? We encounter it when Nadav and Avihu die. Nadav and Avihu die, and immediately Moshe tells their cousins to take their bodies out. Why do they have to take their bodies out? Because their presence, I mean, it's obviously a problem, but their presence is creating tumah. And why can't their own brothers take them out? Because their brothers can't become tameh, which means tumat mate is something that already exists. Right? Besides which, already in Parshat Naso, we're told every tameh mate has to leave. In Parshat Bahalotcha, we hear about people who are tameh mate and can't bring Korban Pesach. So we already hear about Tumat Meit. But the laws show up only in Chukat, in chapter 19, seemingly in the 40th year. So what are we supposed to do with that? So the answer is actually fairly straightforward. We were given the Torah at Har Sinai. When I say Har Sinai, I'm going to read it broadly, which means some of the mitzvot we were given up on top of the mountain, some of the mitzvot inside in the cloud, Mishpatim, some of the mitzvot up on top of the mountain, and many of the mitzvot we were given in Ohel Moed. After we set up the Mishkan, Hashem speaks to Moshe in the Mishkan, like he promised, and gives us the rest of the mitzvot. Very nice. Okay, we got all the mitzvot at Har Sinai, on top, bottom, or in the Mishkan, all at Har Sinai. What happens? And I'll give you an example of this from the book of Bereshit. What happens is that when Moshe is writing the Torah, he puts particular mitzvot in other places in the Torah to connect them to a story. And where does this happen in Bereshit? So I'm going to start by asking a question that will sound like it's very much off topic. We're going to bring it back. If I kill a pig and I eat the sinew of the hindquarters of the pig, did I violate Gid HaNasheh? What do you think? Did I violate eating the Gid HaNasheh? What do you think?
That's the secondary violation.
But okay, but am I liable for eating Gid HaNasheh? So the answer is it's actually a machloket. It's the Mishnah in the seventh parak of Chulin. It's a machloket between Rabbi Yehuda and Chachamim. Rabbi Yehuda says, I am liable, and Chachamim say, I'm not. And what's their reasoning? Who was it who got the prohibition to eat Gid HaNasheh? So Rabbi Yehuda says, Yaakov. It's in the story of Yaakov. Yaakov had a wrestling match, and then it says, therefore, Bnei Israel, don't eat Gid HaNasheh. By the way, was Yaakov allowed to eat pork roast? Sure. Why not? So that means that every animal was available to Yaakov, and if Gid HaNasheh became prohibited, it means it's prohibited in every animal. And therefore, if I eat the Gid HaNasheh of a pig, I eat Gid HaNasheh. But Chachamim saying, no, Gid HaNasheh was given at Har Sinai, which means Yaakov himself could have eaten Gid HaNasheh. Gid HaNasheh was given at Har Sinai. And therefore, when Hashem prohibited Gid HaNasheh, it was only Gid HaNasheh, those animals that you're otherwise allowed to eat. Now, you're right, Robert, that if I ate the Gid HaNasheh of a pig, I might be in violation of eating a pig, depending how much I had. But not Gid HaNasheh, according to Chachamim. So how do we understand it? We understand as follows. The mitzvot were given in Har Sinai. But when Moshe writes the Torah, he puts certain mitzvot next to certain stories to give us the background. This is exactly what the Gemara in Chulin says. That the story of Gid HaNasheh tells us why we avoid it. Therefore, the mitzvah is placed there. So we'll understand the background. But it wasn't given there. And now we roll into the book of Bamidbar, and there's a particular literary style in Bamidbar, which is interesting, which is the Torah tells us a story, and then there's a series of mitzvot that somehow relate to that story. But it doesn't mean those mitzvot were given as a result of the story. They're already given, but now the story has a connection. So, for instance, we were given a mitzvah that when we come into that when we bring a korban, we have to bring with it some oil and some flour and some wine. It's called nesachim. That's a mitzvah. I want to bring a korban shlamim. I have to bring with it, depending on the kind of animal, half, if it's a big animal, half a hin of oil mixed in with three isaron of flour mixed as a mincha and half a hin of wine. Okay. But the Torah writes it immediately in the aftermath of the Meraglim because it's part of the information that we are coming into the land. And those are the three famous products of the land. And it's praise for the land. And then the mitzvah of challah is given. Challah was probably given before. But the idea is that it's connecting it. So it's like saving our relationship with the land, as it were. Parah Duma clearly was given earlier. Why does it show up where it does? Because it shows up right before the death of Miriam and Aaron. It's associated with death. Okay, very good. So now, when was tzitzit given? Tzitzit, we have to assume, was given at Har Sinai. So why does tzitzit show up here, right before Korach? Because tzitzit both connects to the Korach story, which has to be here for another reason, and it connects to the Meraglim story. Look at the wording of the Parsha of tzitzit. What's the goal of it? I said we come back to that. V'lo taturu, do not stray after your eyes and your heart. Where does that word show up? What were the scouts actually called in the Torah? They weren't called spies. What were they called? Hatarim et ha'aretz. Latur et eretz Kanan. They're supposed to seek out the land. The same word is used here. And by the way, in the punishment, Moshe tells them, your children that you thought were going to be killed will bear your sin of straying. Nasu et znutechem. And here it's asher atem zonim achareyem. In other words, the Torah deliberately uses words that connect us with the Meraglim story in the Tzitzit mitzvah, which means if the Meraglim story doesn't happen, I have to still believe we're going to get the mitzvah of Tzitzit, but it might be worded differently. And then it dovetails with the next piece, which is Korach. So they all kind of interweave. Okay. So now let's get back to it. When do we think Korach probably happened? So I'm going to make the following suggestion and then come back to Datan and Aviram. At what point would it be reasonable to challenge Moshe over a selection of Aharon? So again, I'm going to posit it has to be before Nadav and Aviv. Because once Nadav and Aviv are killed holding Torah in their hands, nobody's going to be so foolish to say, okay, I'm going to stand up in front of God with Torah in my hand and see if he likes me or not. It's a very bizarre, masochistic move to make. So what happened before Nadav and Avihu were killed? What was the week before Nadav and Avihu killed? What was happening during that week? That was the 7 days of Miluim, of investiture, of inauguration of the Kohanim, inauguration of the Mikdash and of the Kohanim. And that would make perfect sense at that point for Korach to say to Moshe in front of everybody, you know what, you're the leader, I understand, but why this Mishkan that we're setting up, why have you selected your brother and his sons to take over? What about me and my sons? And so the test is run. It would make a lot of sense that it happened there. I'm simply taking the Ibn Ezra's thinking and moving it back a notch. But you cannot argue that Datan and Aviram at that point have a claim because their claim is you brought us out in the desert to die. Why would we think that? We're camped at the foot of our Sinai. We evidently have an oasis around us. We've been here for almost a year, and now we're camped and we're ready to march. And by the way, why would they have a claim? I'm talking about the Ibn Ezra about being from Shevet Reuven and getting jilted. They're part of a camp that's already it's already not the main camp, not the front camp. Reuven already got jilted a long time ago. So what I'd like to suggest is another piece of the Torah's narrative style, which is to weave stories together that are thematically related, even though they might not be chronologically overlapping or contemporaneous. And that is that we have here a story of rebellion. There is one major rebellion that happened against Moshe, which happened back at the foot of Har Sinai with the selection of the Kohanim, and that's the Korach rebellion. We don't want to tell that in Shmot or Vayikra because that's not what Shmot and Vayikra are about. So it belongs in Bamidbar, which is the story of Am Yisrael struggling with its own identity as a nation. That's what the book is about. It's a book about community. It's a book about census, numbers. But it's a book about the community. And part of the challenge of the community is, how's the community going to work under leadership? By the way, it begins with leadership and ends with transfer of leadership. And so you have a rebellion that takes place at this point in time when they've been told they're going to die in the desert. That's Datan and Aviram. In the meantime, you have a rebellion that happened a while back that gets woven in here, which is the rebellion of Korach. And please take a look here at what happens in this story. Here's what I did. I took the story and I simply painted it. And you notice that Korach and then Datan and Aviram. So now the whole interaction with Korach, which we talked about with the censers and the Ketoret, is in blue. And then Moshe separately summons for Datan and Aviram. And they say, oh, you didn't bring us to a good land. You brought us to a bad land. And now Moshe speaks to Korach. Notice, at only one point does he ever talk to all three of them because they're not the same story. We'll have to see that one place. Now Moshe says to Korach, you guys stand with your Ketoret. Let's see what happens. Okay. And then what happens here? We now get to Datan and Aviram. And Datan and Aviram, he comes and they all come outside. And Moshe says, okay, you think I'm not God's agent? Fine. If I'm not God's agent, nothing will happen now. If I am God's agent, then the earth's going to open up and swallow you, and that's exactly what happens. But Korach's not part of that. Korach's somewhere else. In the meantime, what happens? Fire comes out and devours the 250 men holding the Torah. I told you. Nadav and Avihu.
Why, Rabbi, do you say Korach someplace else? He's not part of those who are swallowed up.
Because in the last pasuk here, it says fire came out from God and devoured the 250 men who were having the Torah, who held the Torah, which is Korach's people. So it's as if there's two different stories going on. There's a story about people getting swallowed up by an earthquake, and there's a story about 250 rebels getting burned up holding Torah. So the Torah story is the Korach story. And when Moshe comes out, he speaks to Datan and Aviram. Take a look here. Right? And he speaks to them. He says, get away. And Datan and Aviram come out, right? And they come out with their families. And Moshe says, now you'll know that I'm really the sent. If I, God did not send me, if you die a regular death, but if God creates something, opens up the earth, et cetera, et cetera. Good. And what happens here is we have a couple phrases that are problematic. Hashem says, get everybody around to the place of Korach, Datan, Aviram, and the place of Korach, Datan, Aviram, fine. But then all the interactions are Datan, Aviram, and not Korach. And then suddenly in here, it says, Kol Adam Asher LeKorach. And it's as if the text is deliberately trying to weave together two disparate stories, which clearly in the rest of the text are different things. The claim is different, the people are different, and no point do they get mixed in together. That's why the red and the blue are separate. And it says that the text is trying to say, look, we're trying to tell you stories about rebellion. There's two very major rebellions that happened, and we're weaving them together into one story so you'll see this is what rebellion looks like. It's not the only time that that happens. Back in chapter 11, we had three verses about people who had a big lust, and then fire came down and burned them up. And then we had other people grumbling about the food. There's nothing that says that that's at the same time, but that's the food grumbling story, right? And then there is the we're going to die in the desert story. That's the Meraglim. And then there's the rebellion story. That's Korach. Basically, what Bamidbar is a collection of the various narratives that happen from Sinai, after leaving Sinai, or being at Sinai, until getting to the entering point to Israel, and all of the difficulties they endured and how they came through them, in some cases scarred, in some cases unscathed. And so we take a look at it, and then we see that the connection between tzitzit and Korach, which becomes prominent in the Midrash and prominent in Korach's words, is really occasioned by the deliberate literary placement of these pieces where they are in order to give us more insight into what's going on. The Torah is not concerned with chronology except where it is, meaning the default is that it's not. And there's myriad examples of that in the Torah where stories are not told in order because the order is not the point. The point is the message. And here the message is how you deal with rebellion. And you notice that Moshe deals with each rebellion separately on its own terms. You notice how brilliantly Moshe responds to Korach by switching the mode of the challenge so that ultimately the truth prevails. And when he comes to Datan and Aviram, it's a whole different challenge. It's a whole different problem, and he deals with it that way also. Moshe does not deal with it in a monochromatic way, but rather in an appropriate way for each rebellion. And it's woven together because the purpose of this section of Bamidbar is to talk about rebellions. So a different way to look at the story of Korach and the role of Datan Aviram in there. And keep these pages because it'll be helpful to see it with the color to see how these different things play out.
Right. Todah Ravah.